Epilogue. 1. Most of them died in the fire. Not all. 100 or more never reached the clearing at all before the ship pulled itself out of the ground and disappeared into the sky. Some, like Elt Barker, who had gone flying off his motorcycle, did not reach it because they had been wounded or killed on the way. Fortunes of war. Others, like Ashley Ruval and Old Miss Timms, who was the town librarian on Tuesdays and Thursdays, were simply too late or too slow. Nor were all those who did reach the clearing killed. The ship had gone into the sky, and the awful draining power which had seized them dwindled away to nothing before the fire reached the clearing, although by then sparks were drifting down and many of the smaller trees at the eastern edge were blazing. Some of them managed to stumble and limp further into the woods ahead of that spreading fiery fan. Of course, going straight west was no good to these few. Rosalie Scahan was among them, as were Frank Spruce and Rudy Barfield, brother of the late and mostly unlamented Pitts, because eventually they would run out of breathable air, in spite of the prevailing winds. So it was necessary to first go west, and then turn either south or north in an effort to buttonhook around the firefront. A desperation play, where the penalty for failure was not losing the ball, but being roasted to cinders in Big Engine Woods. A few, not all, but a few, actually did make it. Most, however, died in the clearing where Bobby Anderson and Jim Gardner had worked so long and hard. Died within feet of that empty socket where something had been buried and then pulled. They had been used roughly by a power which was much greater than the early tentative state of their becoming could cope with. The ship had reached out to the net of their minds, seized it, and used it to obey the controller's weak but unmistakable command, which had been expressed as warp speed to the ship's organic cybernetic circuits. The words warp speed were not in the ship's vocabulary, but the concept was clear. The living lay on the ground, most unconscious, some deeply dazed. A few sat up, holding their heads and moaning, oblivious of the sparks drifting down around them. Some, mindful of the danger coming from the east, tried to get up and fell back. One of those who did not fall back was Chip McCausland, who lived on Dugout Road with his common-law wife and about 10 kids. 2 months and 1 million years ago, Bobby Anderson had gone to Chip for more egg cartons to hold her expanding collection of batteries. Chip shambled halfway across the clearing like an old drunk and fell into the empty trench. He tumbled, shrieking, all the way to the bottom, where he died of a broken neck and a shattered skull. Others who understood the danger of the fire and who could possibly have gotten away elected not to do so. The becoming was at an end. It had ended with the departure of the ship. The purpose of their lives had been cancelled. So they only sat and waited for the fire to take care of what remained of them. 2. By nightfall, there were less than 200 people left alive in Haven. Most of the township's heavily wooded western half had burned or was burning flat. The wind grew stronger yet. The air began to change, and the remaining Tommyknockers, gasping and whey-faced, gathered in Hazel McCready's yard. Phil Golden and Bryant Brown got the big air exchanger going. The survivors gathered around it as homesteaders might once have gathered around a stove on a bitter night. Their tortured breathing gradually eased. Bryant looked over at Phil. Weather for tomorrow? Clear skies, diminishing winds. Marie was standing nearby, and Bryant saw her relax.
Good. That's good.
And so it was, for the time being. But the winds were not going to remain calm for the rest of their lives. And with the ship gone, there was only this gadget and 24 truck batteries between them and eventual strangulation.
How long?
Bryant asked, and no one answered. There was only the flat shine of their frightened, inhuman eyes in the fire-shot night. 3. The following morning, there were 20 less. During the night, John Leandro's story had broken worldwide, with all the force of a hammerfall. State and Defense departments denied everything, but dozens of people had taken photographs as the ship rose. These photographs were persuasive, and no one could stop the flood of leaks from such informed sources as frightened residents of the surrounding towns and the first arriving National Guardsmen. The Haven border barriers held, at least for the time being. The fire front had advanced into Newport, where the flames were finally being brought under control. Several Tommyknockers blew their brains out in the night. Polly Andrews swallowed Drano. Phil Golden awoke to discover that Queenie, his wife of 20 years, had jumped into Hazel McCready's dry well. That day there were only 4 suicides, but the nights were worse. By the time the army finally broke into Haven, like inept burglars into a strong safe, later that week, there were less than 80 Tommyknockers left. Justin Hurd shot a fat army sergeant with a kid's Daisy air rifle that squirted green fire. The fat sergeant exploded. A scared E-4 in the APC, just then roaring past Cooter's Market, turned the .50 caliber he was sitting behind on Justin Hurd, who was standing in front of the hardware store, wearing only a yellowing pair of Hanes underpants and his orange work shoes. "Fix them woodchucks!" Justin was screaming. "Fix them all! You're fucking A! You're—" Then he was hit by some 20 .50 caliber slugs. Justin nearly exploded, too. The E-4 puked into his gas mask and nearly choked on the stuff before someone could get a fresh one over his face. "Someone get that pop gun!" a major shouted through an electric bullhorn. His mask muffled his words, but did not destroy them. "Get it, but be careful. Pick it up by the barrel. I repeat, be extremely careful. Don't point it at anyone." Pointing it at someone, guard would have said, always comes later. 4. More than a dozen were shot down on the first day of the invasion by scared, trigger-happy soldiers, kids, most of them, who pursued the Tommyknockers from house to house. After a while, some of the invaders' fear began to rub off. By afternoon, they were actually having fun. They were like men driving rabbits through wheat. 2 dozen more were killed before the Army doctors and Pentagon brain trusters realized that the air outside of Haven was lethal to these freak show mutations who had once been American taxpayers. The fact that the invaders could not breathe the air inside Haven would have seemed to have made the converse self-evident, but in all the excitement, no one was really thinking very well. Guard wouldn't have found this very surprising. Now there were only 40 or so. Most were insane. Those who weren't wouldn't talk. A makeshift stockade was built in the area which passed for a town square in Haven Village, just below and to the right of the towerless town hall. They were kept there for another week, and during that period, another 14 died. The changed air was analyzed. The machine which manufactured it was carefully studied. The failing batteries were replaced. As Bobby had suggested, it didn't take the brain trusters long to understand the mechanics of the device, and the underlying principles were already being studied at MIT, Caltech, Bell Labs, and the shop in Virginia by scientists who were nearly vomiting with excitement. The remaining 26 Tommyknockers, looking like the weary, pox-rattled remnants of the final Apache tribe in existence, were flown in the controlled environment cargo bay of a C-140 Starlifter to a government installation in Virginia. This installation, which had once been burned to the ground by a child, was the shop. There they were studied, and there they died, one by one by one. The last survivor was Alice Kimball, the schoolteacher who was a lesbian, a fact Becca Paulson had learned from Jesus one hot day in July. She died on October 31st, Halloween. 5. At about the same time Queenie Golden was standing on the edge of Hazel's dry well and preparing to jump in, a nurse stepped into Hilly Brown's room to check on the boy, who had shown some faint signs of returning consciousness over the last couple of days. She looked at the bed and frowned. She couldn't be seeing what she was seeing. It was an illusion of some kind, a double shadow thrown onto the wall by the light from the corridor. She flipped the wall switch and took a step closer. Her mouth dropped open. It hadn't been an illusion. There were two shadows on the wall because there were two boys in the bed. They slept with their arms wrapped around each other.
What?
She took another step, her hand going unconsciously to the crucifix she wore around her neck. One of them, of course, was Hilly Brown, his face thin and wasted, his arms seemingly no thicker than sticks, his skin nearly as white as his hospital Johnny. She didn't know the other boy, who was very young. He was wearing blue shorts and a T-shirt which read, "They call me Dr. Love." His feet were black with dirt, and something about that dirt seemed unnatural to her.
What?
She whispered again, and the younger boy stirred and wrapped his arms more tightly around Hilly's neck. His cheek rested against Hilly's shoulder, and she saw, with something like terror, that the boys looked very much alike. She decided she had to tell Dr. Greenleaf about this, right now. She turned to leave, heart beating fast, one hand still clutching at her crucifix, and saw something that was quite impossible.
What?
She whispered for the third and last time. Her eyes were very wide. More of that strange black dirt. On the floor. Tracks on the floor, leading to the bed. The little boy had crossed to the bed and gotten in. The two boys' facial resemblance suggested that this was Hilly's missing and long since presumed dead brother. The tracks didn't come from the hall. They started in the middle of the floor, as if the little boy had come from nowhere. The nurse bolted from the room, screaming for Dr. Greenleaf. 6. Hilly Brown opened his eyes.
David? Shut up, Hilly. I'm sleeping.
Hilly smiled, not sure where he was, not sure when he was, sure only that many things had been wrong. Just what those things had been no longer mattered because everything was okay now. David was here, warm and solid against him.
Me too, Hilly said. We got to trade G.I. Joe's tomorrow.
Why?
I don't know, but we got to. I promise.
When?
I don't know.
As long as I get Crystal Ball,
David said, settling himself more firmly into the crook of Hilly's arm.
Well, okay.
Silence. There was a dim commotion at the nurse's station down the hall, but here there was silence and the sweet warmth of boys.
Hilly?
What? Hilly muttered.
It was cold where I was.
Was it?
Yes.
Better now?
Better. I love you, Hilly.
I love you too, David.
I'm sorry.
For what?
I don't know.
Oh.
David's hand groped for the blanket, found it, and pulled it up. 93 million miles from the sun, and 100 parsecs from the axis pole of the galaxy, Hilly and David Brown slept in each other's arms. August 19th, 1982. May 19th, 1987.
This concludes the reading of The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Copyright 1987 by Stephen King, Tabitha King, and Arthur B. Green, Trustee. This book was read by Edward Herman. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with NAL Signet, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright.